Mayor, you mean?
Ha! Touché.
He raised his fist, and Ella bumped his knuckles.
Watch those stairs, and take some aspirin.
Will do. She turned to leave, took a few careful steps down the hallway, and stopped. Wait a second, Hector.
What's up?
Ella stared at the ecru wall, on which the light overhead made a strange, lurid pattern. Or maybe not. Maybe the pattern was just the bourbon smoking her eyeballs. She licked her lips. So, I had fun tonight.
Yeah, me too. Knew you were kindred, under that suit you wear out the door in the morning.
Kindred?
You know, certain people you can just sit down at a piano together and play.
Right. She blinked hard. Also, I kind of lied to you back there. He didn't reply. Ella gathered her breath, didn't turn around. That would be too much. Anyway, the floor was already unsteady beneath her. Kindred. Not exactly lied, I guess, she continued. About why I moved here, I mean. I just didn't tell you the truth.
The whole truth and nothing but the truth?
Sort of.
Big deal or small deal?
I don't know. I guess it's a big deal to me.
Well, I guess we all have secrets, right?
Ella turned after all, gripped the stair railing for balance. Hector stood tall in the doorway, sturdy and wiry and remarkably still. His face was heavy with fatigue. Nellie had wandered over and now stared in sleepy curiosity from between his legs, yawning, showing off a set of small, sharp teeth. Hector braced one hand on the doorframe and waited for her. "So it's like this," she said. "I left my husband 3 weeks ago because I caught him having sex with a prostitute."
Act 2. We come to an understanding, of sorts. River Junction, Maryland, 1924. 1. Now, the B&O branch line into River Junction runs a passenger train but once a day, and even so I find myself in possession of a carriage nearly empty, except for a middle-aged woman in widow's weeds who stares through the window the entire journey, though a book lies open in her lap. I don't blame the folks who aren't present. Why should you travel into the frigid crook between two godforsaken mountains in the middle of far western Maryland, in the middle of winter, unless you have urgent business calling you there? No reason at all. Like the widow, I observe the passing drifts of snow, the pastures all tucked under smooth white blankets, the gray horizon bleeding into the gray sky, the mountain hills and the small broken-down houses huddled between them. And I cannot raise the slightest whiff of longing. Just a sick weight growing in my stomach, fed by the rattle of wheels and sight of the smoke trailing from all those lonely chimneys. The smell of burning Pennsylvania anthracite. 2. The last time I saw my mother, she lay in bed. She spent a lot of time in bed, my mother, with one thing or another. 9.5 months after marrying Duke Kelly, she heaved out 10 pounds of Johnny from between her narrow hips, and she never really was the same after that. Not that Duke seemed to care much about Mama's state of health, I guess, because she went on to whelp 3 more boys, one after another, like a crumbling sausage factory that somehow continues to churn out sausages, and then 2 girls who died a month later, and then, well, I lost track by then, because I was mostly at the convent, getting an education. All I know is that she kept falling sick, which is the name we give to a miscarriage out here in the country, and lastly had another girl the year I started college. That's Patsy. She'll be rising 5 years old now, if she's made it this far. My baby sister. Anyhow, the last time I saw Mama, she was sitting up in bed, nursing wee Patsy. And when I told her I was quitting college and running off to New York City right that very morning, she didn't even look up. Didn't even meet my eye. Just brushed back a bit of limp hair from her temple and told me not to be getting myself in trouble. And I thought, you're one to talk. Not in a sour vein, but rather a pitying one. I asked if I could hold Patsy and say goodbye. And she said, no, baby's nursing. So I just leaned over and kissed Patsy's velvet crown, and then Mama's temple, and breathed in the scent of milk and skin. And I said, I'll be going now. And funny thing, when I straightened up my eyes, I found the window. And right through the middle of that dirty square marched Duke himself, doing something to the button of his trousers. And I turned away so Mama wouldn't see my face. And you may be sure I departed the premises directly that minute, carrying my little carpet bag in one hand and my coat in the other, running out the front door so he wouldn't spot me. Heat rising from the grass, train whistle crying down the tracks. Sent my address 2 weeks later not to Mama, but to Johnny, because Duke always opens Mama's mail but doesn't give much damn about any business of Johnny's. Speak of train whistles, there goes, thin and short. And 2 seats ahead of me, the widow starts in her seat. Glances over her shoulder in my direction, under guise of looking for the conductor. Her face is plump and well-fed, not a trace of want. "Excuse me," she says. "Is you Geneva Rose Kelly?" I replied cagily. "I am." "Why, they lord, don't you know me?" "Should I know you?" "It's Ruth Mary Leary, you old so-and-so. We was at school together, recollect?" "Ruth Mary, of course." Laying on a thick, false coating of enthusiasm as I picked through the old stacks of memory. "Course, I was just Ruth Mary Green back then, before me and Eddie ran off to Baltimore to get hitched. You remember that, I reckon." She laughs. "Course I do. Talk of the town. Mama Lacta murdered Eddie. She surely did. How are you these days, Ruth Mary?" I say these words with knowing tenderness, because her costume suggests that someone dear, likely Eddie, whoever the devil he is, must have gone and turned toes up in the recent past. And I can see she expects I've heard all about her sorrows and joys over the years. That I make it my habit to keep current on the patter of River Junction elopements and birthins and passins on. Ruth Mary Green. I have some general impression of bony knees and a dirty, wan face. Long, straight hair worn in 2 braids. A blue calico dress. The River Junction schoolyard, which I last inhabited when I was but 8 years old. Ruth Mary's face sinks a little. "Course, it was awful when Eddie passed on." "Course." The train makes that first soft lurch, breaking down for the River Junction station. The lurch that tells you it's time to gather your things and make your apologies. Ruth takes no notice.
"But your daddy's taking right good care of us, right good care. He's a right good man, your daddy."
I make for my pocketbook and my little satchel so she can't see my face as I reply. "He surely is.
I'm a-comin' from Hagerstown, callin' on my sister. You recollect Lorianne? Done had herself another baby girl, doin' just fine. You here to see your mama?"
"I am."
"I hope she ain't took a turn for the worse."
"She has, I'm afraid. Johnny wired me last night."
"They lord, I'll send something over. Poor Mr. Kelly, he does dote on her."
This time when I reply, my smile is tacked on with care and attention, bright as you please. Like bees on nectar. 3. Ruth wants to know if anyone's meeting me at the station, and I tell her no. I didn't have time to wire ahead. I thought I'd walk.
"Walk? You can't walk in this, Geneva Rose. My brother Carl's a meeting me in the Ford. Be more than pleased to give you a lift."
"You needn't bother. I like the walk."
"Why, don't talk nonsense. You know Duke like to have our hides if we let his baby girl walk home from the station in all this."
She nods to the piles of dirty snow creeping past the window. The platform appears suddenly, crisp and gray, giving me some kind of startle, because there never was a platform at River Junction Station before, let alone one shoveled free of precipitation. Just limp grass and beaten mud. The clapboard corner of the depot edges into view and stops, concurrent with the final lurch of the train and the sigh of the steam. "Here we are," says Ruth. "Home again. Sight for sore eyes, ain't it?" "Not yet 4 years gone altogether," I collect, "since I parted ways with River Junction, and I have tried not to give the place another thought since. Easy enough, when you are living in the bosom of Manhattan, encircled by an urban landscape of buildings and more buildings, mountain into the sky. Stone and pavement and patches of stubborn parkland, jumbles of enchanting humanity in all its various states of dress and undress, wealth and unwealth, cathedrals and skyscrapers and mansions and slums, monuments to snatch your heartbeat, tenements to choke the breath right down in your lungs. And above all that, the restless, reckless churn of motion. New York City is one thing never, and that is standing still. But here, here at the River Junction Railway Depot, a brief western outpost on a meager branch line of the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, as the train rests and sighs and Ruth Mary Leary reaches out a widowy black arm to push open the door and hump her suitcase across the step to this interesting brand-new platform, the whole world around us is just plain frozen, frozen and empty. Same station house, sleeping in the snow. Strange in its old familiarity. An exact replication of a building I knew in another life. A life I did my best to forget. Except, if I'm not mistaken, the clapboard siding has been painted a bright new red. And the beaten-up row of stores across the street, Kathy's Cafe, the Five and Dime, Ned McDonald's Hardware Store, share an unaccustomed sharpness in their general demeanor, as if a smart-mouthed nun from an especially strict order marched up and told them to straighten their signboards and fix their windows and wash away all the dirt. Not that I speak from experience, you understand. And is that fellow with the shovel actually clearing snow from the sidewalk? Is that actually a sidewalk? I seem to have come to a stop, there on the unexpected railway platform, staring at the unexpected purity of River Junction's center of commerce, such as it is. The wind blows cold on my cheek. My fingers clench around the handle of my satchel. Someone taps my shoulder and says something, and he has to repeat his words. "Excuse me, ma'am, is this your pocketbook?" Before I startle out of my thoughts and turn. The conductor, burly fellow, holding out a plain black pocketbook in his gloved right hand. I nod my head and snatch the pocketbook and say thank you, brusque with embarrassment, and he says, "My pleasure, ma'am. Will there be anything else?" And something about the tone of that voice makes me look up at his face and the dark blue eyes watching me steadily beneath the round brim of his conductor's cap. "Hey, Lord," I say.
"Let me know if you need any help, ma'am," he says, stony-voiced, no expression whatever.
"No help needed. Thank you." Ruth tugs at my arm and tells me her brother Carl's right over there in the Ford. "Come along. Won't take no for an answer." So I oblige, turn away from that aggravating damp conductor, and march down the platform at Ruth's side, satchel banging against my leg. Wouldn't do to be rude now, would it? 4. The ride is short. As I said, a mere half-mile separates Duke Kelly's ramshackle abode from the railway depot, and Ruth Mary Leary's brother Carl has acquired himself a fine new Model T Ford, engine purring like an overfed cat, the kind of automobile that makes easy work of a country road, even in wintertime. Carl's delighted to see me. Seems he went to school with Johnny.
"Recollect how we used to catch them crawdads in the old fishing hole down by the creek? You was covered in dirt back then, Geneva Rose. Knees all skinned, dress up to here." He points to his shinbone. fixed to steal a kiss from you once, and Lord Almighty, did you let me have it. Never did try again.
Wise decision. He laughs.
I always knowed you were gonna bust out of River Junction for good. You was that kind of girl. Reckon you own half New York by now.
Not quite. It's a big town, after all. An island unto itself.
Reckon you got some high-class fella to step you out these days. That right? Reckon your knees ain't skin no more, no ma'am. You done cleaned up right smart, Geneva Rose, just like I knowed you would.
Ruth Mary spears his ribs with her elbow.
Now, you quit your teasing, Carl Green. Geneva's back home on account of her mama sick.
Oh, I'm sorry. Forgot about all that. Didn't mean to offend.
Looks back at me, over his shoulder, and his blue eyes are kind. Oh, that's all right, Carl, I say. Laughter's the best medicine, they always say. Already we've turned the corner of Front Street, and Duke's abode stands but 75 yards ahead on the right side of the road. Me, I happen to be staring leftward, toward the astonishing sight of a brand new house getting itself built. A large house made of red brick, full dozen busy workmen crawling all over its skin, almost as if it weren't the middle of winter and this the middle of River Junction.
Why, whose house is that?
I cry out from the back seat.
Which one, sugar?
The brick one, the one that's getting built.
Why, don't you know? That there is your brother Angus's house, fixing to get married in June. That house be his wedding present from your daddy.
Here we are, sings out Ruth.
Carl breaks hard, sending the flivver into a bit of skid across the firm-packed snow covering the road, and Ruth screams a little. Carl just laughs. As for me, so discombobulated am I from the sight of Angus's grand brick house and the precarious sliding of the Ford's new tires, I turn my head right bang in the direction of my childhood abode to fill my eyes. A mistake I hoped never again to make in this life. But the sight that strikes my eyeballs isn't the sight I expect. And maybe I should have expected that. Maybe I should have taken note of the spruced-up railway depot and the spruced-up businesses and the grand new house getting built as a wedding present for my worthless brother Angus. Maybe I should have thought more thoroughly through the implications of what Special Agent Anson disclosed to me last night. Was it just last night? In his shoddy little office along the rim of 10th Avenue. Not a little business, Miss Kelly. Your stepfather has built a network of distilleries across Allegheny County and beyond, and nobody will say a word against him. Now, the first time I came home from the convent on a school holiday, it was a day much like this. Winter. Christmas around the corner, and the first fall of snow had newly hit the ground, covering the rotten remains of autumn. Mama and Johnny came to the station to walk me home. I wore my shabby little clothes, my threadbare coat through which the wind whistled and froze on my skin. Wee satchel in one hand, carrying my all. Fingers still stinging by the wrong end of Sister Esme's ruler. Mama clutched Johnny's wrist and waved as I stepped from the train. She was great with child, coat straining mightily over the weight of her belly, eyes all hooded and weary, hat full of holes. I ran up to her, and she bent and hugged me, and then she straightened and looked me up and looked me down. And I remember the expression on her face, because I couldn't decide was she happy or was she sad. Some frictional combination of the two, I guess, peculiar to grown-ups. Anyway, we trudged home through the darkening snow and arrived at the house, Duke Kelly's house, and Johnny opened the creaking gate and I looked up and took it in, the house of my childhood. And I saw things I hadn't seen before. I saw the peeling white paint and the sagging boards, the bricks crumbling from the chimney, and the way the porch slanted downward by a few unhappy degrees. And I thought something sort of strange for a little girl to think, an idea made unusually of clear, distinct words that still ring in my head. This is not my home. Just like that, this is not my home. As I stood there by the gate, experiencing this alienation, the front door opened, and there stood Duke, wearing his neat suit of brown wool, the lord of this dilapidated little manor, looking us over as if he owned us, as if we were cattle wandering in from the cold. And the thought, this is not my home, flared up stronger and fiercer, almost fixing me to vomit with its clarity. This is not my home. You cannot go back from a thought like that. You cannot return to a state of childlike trust in a building, a state of affection for all its faults, just because that house represents some kind of refuge from the outside world. Once you reject that house, or maybe that house rejects you, I don't know. Your hatred can only mount and mount until the walls themselves seem to poison you, the very surfaces of the furniture to fester under your touch. The day I passed through that front door for the last time, it was like a layer of foul skin peeled away from my body and slithered to the porch behind me, and I have never looked back. I never once turned my head for a last look. Now it's gone. That sagging white house, home to Kelly since about the Revolution, where Duke Kelly himself entered the world in the same upstairs bedroom as his daddy before him and his own sons after, has disappeared. In its place stands a building that might as well be the town hall, so far as I can see faced in limestone, crammed tight with every architectural feature you can imagine. Palladian windows and Jacobean parapets and friezes and bay windows and God knows. Stretches 50 feet in each direction from a front door like the entrance to a cathedral. Lord Almighty, I say. What's that?
Why, it's your daddy's new house. Ain't they sent you no pictures? Mr. Kelly's right proud of that place.
No. Carl sets the brake and jumps out to hump my carpet bag.
Well, there it is.
Ain't it grand? Sighs out Ruth. Just like that Morgan fella in New York. Just exactly like. I take the bag from Carl, whose face wears an expression of intelligent mischief. And what do you know? I actually recall him. Recall an afternoon down by the creek, full of heat and mud and blood-drunk skeeters, and a boy with an unusual pointed face like an elf, who snatched me out of the water and tugged me into the bushes and held his hand over my mouth, grinning and grinning. And I was so mad and helpless, imprisoned by his skinny arms, until I heard my stepfather's voice floating down the grassy bank and realized that this boy had actually rescued me. Staring at me just as he stares now. Blue eyes twinkly and all-knowing, like they see right through the substance of my little troubles. That was my first kiss. Didn't last long. I slapped him for it a second later. Carl Green, what do you know? I hold out my hand and say, thank you. And I'm not talking about the ride home. Well, the mischief fades a little. He takes the hand and shakes it. Warm palm melts through my glove.
You take care of yourself, Geneva Rose.
I surely will. A big voice roars from between the pillars on the brand new portico.
Carl Green, you son of a bitch! Get your lousy hands off my sister!
That's Johnny, as if you couldn't guess. 5. My kid brother wraps me up in a hug that might turn a weaker mortal into a diamond. Johnny always was 2 sizes bigger than the other boys, even when he was born. They used to get up games of football in the schoolyard, and Johnny just plowed right over everybody.
"Where's Mama?" I ask when he lets me go.
"Upstairs. How's yourself, sis? You look different."
"I am different. So are you. What kind of joint is this?"
"You should see the inside."
"I would if you'd invite me through the door."
Big old familiar belly laugh. Johnny's laugh can cure any trouble. He takes my carpet bag and turns to usher me through the door, and I tilt away to wave goodbye to Carl and Ruth, but they're already gone. Smell of gasoline exhaust foul in the air behind them. The door stands open, allowing expansive gusts of warm air to escape into the winter afternoon. Johnny sends me into the foyer and follows, shutting the door behind us. and I'll be damned if a fellow in a black and white uniform doesn't appear from the doorway to the right, Harold slicked back, asking me for my coat in broad country cadence. As I obey, I peer into his scrubbed face and dark eyes.
Why, Tommy Leary, is that you?
Tommy sort of flushes and says it sure is. How is you, Geneva Rose? I hand him my coat and say I'm just fine. Stop by to see my mama. Around us, the foyer takes shape. Polished wood paneling and white marble floor. A god-awful chandelier bursting from the ceiling 20 feet above. Twin staircases curving upward to form some kind of gallery. I nod toward them.
That way?
Turn right at the top. Johnny'll show you. He speaks in a tone of hushed reverence, or so near to hushing in reverence as a fellow like Tommy Leary can manage, and the very respect in his voice sends my pulse throbbing like a dynamo. I toss my coat into his arms and stride across the slippery dam marble to the rightmost staircase, and as I bound upward and wheel ride and race down the corridor, I take no notice of the statuary and the portraiture and the red and gold wallpaper, nor yet the plush crimson carpet and the scrolling plasterwork on the ceiling above. I just think, Mama, poor Mama, left to decay in a mausoleum like this.
6.
No expense spared on Mama's bedroom, I'll say that. If Duke Kelly is the new king of River Junction, this chamber is fit for his queen. 12-foot ceilings and a canopied bed, French furniture gilded upright. She's even got a lady-in-waiting, some kind of uniformed nurse who hovers near the window, eyes snarling at me as I bend over Mama's sleeping body.
"She mustn't be disturbed," snaps the nurse.
I send her a glance, no more. "Pardon me, I'm Geneva Kelly, Mrs. Kelly's daughter, and I expect I'll do what is damned well best for her." Behind me, Johnny makes a coughing noise. Mama may be sleeping, but not in peace. Her eyelids twitch. Her fingers claw the glossy satin counterpane. Her skin is pale and fine, such that I can follow the disturbing passage of blood along the network of arteries and capillaries and veins, back to her heart, pulsing through again. Someone once told me, I can't remember whom, that Mama was a great beauty in her youth. I suppose she must have been. After all, she ran off to New York when she was but 16 and joined some kind of show, dancing and singing for the entertainment of ladies and gentlemen. Mostly gentlemen, I suspect. Inevitably, one of them sired me, but the funny thing is, she didn't return to River Junction right away after this disgrace. She stayed on in Manhattan for 2 more years, and when she returned, she was still bright and well-fed, as her wedding photograph attests. How I used to stare at that photograph of Mama, snapped just before Duke got into her. The only glimpse I had of the real Mama, clean and untainted. Her eyes are hooded, mysterious. Her brows a pair of long, elegant arches, slightly bent at the ends. Smooth dairy skin, lips set in a melancholy young pout entirely unsuited to the happy occasion of a respectable marriage meant to save her from mortal sin. But she's lovely, no doubt about that. And what's more, there exists no hint of my own existence in that photograph, either hiding coyly in her big white skirt or disturbing the perfection of her small white waist. Just her smirking new husband at her side, a head taller, eyes a little blurred as if recovering from a blink. The point is, she was beautiful once. And you can still trace the contours of that beauty in her bones. Perhaps better than before because her skin now sinks like a drape along her skeleton, exposing the angles of symmetry, exposing the loving hand of God in her creation. Maybe she feels my breath on her cheek because her eyes crack open for an instant, her head turns in my direction, and then the lids fall back twitching and a sort of moan slips free from her desiccated lips. The carpet rustles.
"See what you've done," says the nurse.
What's the matter with her?
She's in the last stages of a consumption, as you can see.
What kind of consumption?
Ah, now, Geneva Rose, says my brother softly. You know she's been like this for years, just getting worse and worse.
Having so many babies, I guess. That kind of consumption.
Nobody says a word.
Mama's breath bubbles in her lungs, offers the nurse.
It's God's will.
Or Duke's will, I guess, which is much the same thing. I place my hands over hers, hoping to still that goddamned clawing. But the knuckles keep on sliding beneath my palms, all bone. And another moan slips out, more like a sigh.
My mama's dying.
I remove my hands and straighten the counterpane and turn to Johnny.
I could use a drink.
7.
Seems Duke's house has a special room for such purposes. Drinking and smoking and what have you. I guess most folks would call it a library. There's bookshelves anyway, with real books in them, from all appearances. Smell of smoke and leather and tobacco. Maybe a hint of good country whiskey.
Winter sun poking between the curtains. Johnny mixes me something while I stand next to a baronial marble mantel and light a cigarette.
Have a seat, he calls.
The room is wide, but I shake my head. The fire is made of coal and burns hot. Melts the stockings right off my legs. I have no intention of moving away from such delicious, unending warmth as that.
We never used to have such fires, I observe.
Things have changed around here.
No kidding.
I flick a little ash into the fire and turn to face Johnny, who's making his way across the acre or so of oriental carpet, bearing a lowball glass in each hand.
Your daddy's special recipe?
It ain't gonna kill you if that's what you mean.
No, I guess not. He's not the kind of fellow to poison his own well, is he? Nonetheless, I sniff before sipping. Rye whiskey, pure and pungent. Neither one of us proposes a toast. Doesn't seem proper with Mama dying upstairs. Johnny drinks about half in one gulp and lifts his massive elbow to the fireboard. Peers into my face in his mute, slow way. I sip again and say, "How long has Mama been sick like this?"
"Ain't she always been like this?"
"Don't say ain't, Johnny. I raised you better than that." He finishes the drink and pulls a cigarette case from his pocket. A gold one that reminds me of Billy's cigarette case, except Johnny's is more ornate. Swirls and curly cues all embossed around the sides. His monogram and letters so complicated, I take their identity on faith.
"Nice box.
So you're on the take, I guess." He pulls out a cigarette and lights up clumsily.
"Last month, about Christmas. I reckon she fell sick again."
"The usual?" He nods. Turns to the fire and rests both paws on the edge of the fireboard. Cigarette burns quietly from between two meaty fingers.
"Some kind of infection got in. Couldn't shake it. Dad called in all kinds of doctors."
"I'll bet."
"He did, though."
"I don't doubt it." "And where is the great humanitarian now?"
"Business meeting."
"Does he know I'm here?" Johnny straightens and snatches a drag from his cigarette. His long, broad nose looks a little pink to me.
"Reckon he does now."
"You don't say.
He's reading minds, is he?"
"Geneva Rose, the first thing you gotta understand, ain't nobody comes in or out of River Junction these days without Duke Kelly knows it."
We stand there staring at each other, absorbing the heat of the fire. Johnny's got this funny thing about his eyes, one kind of blue and the other one greener. Also, the pupil's larger in the blue one. You have to be standing close to notice this. And the effect, combined with his giant frame and strange, bony face, can give you a regular case of the willies if you aren't already acquainted with the fact that Johnny Kelly is a gentle old pussycat, sweetest honey heart in Allegheny County. Wouldn't hurt a flea unless it was carrying a football toward the wrong set of goalposts. God only knows where he gets his nature from. Not his daddy.
"How long has he been running this racket?" I ask.
"Since right about the day you left, I guess. Near enough, anyway.
Figured out Carl Green's daddy was cooking up rye mash in his barn and making a few nice dollars on the side, selling it on to some outfit in Hagerstown. Well, Duke went straight to Hagerstown and convinced that fella to let him run the business instead.
Did he now? Did he shoot the poor sucker dead, or just wave the gun in his face?
Nah, Geneva. You know Duke don't like guns.
I toss the end of my cigarette into the fire and hand Johnny my empty glass. Refill, dearest. Johnny ambles back off across the rug, wrinkled suit jacket swinging from his wide shoulders, and I light another cigarette and start off along the row of bookshelves lining the wall, each one crammed tight with rigid new leather-bound volumes. Mahogany gleams under the electric light. I run my finger along a gold-stamped spine. Tristram Shandy, blow me down. And ask Johnny where Duke got all the damn books.
Robbed the wrong storefront in Baltimore? Hired a dealer, I guess. Said he wanted the best library in the county.
I allow a low whistle. How much lettuce is he clearing, do you think?
I don't keep the books.
You can guess. 100,000? 200?
Maybe something like that, maybe more.
Another whistle. 300 large a year. Johnny walks up and hands me my second rye whiskey.
A month?
$300,000 a month?
Sputter of whiskey.
Something like that. Less expenses.
Oh, naturally, expenses. You've got to pay everybody off for one thing. All those revenue agents and policemen don't come cheap, I'll bet. To say nothing of butlers and country estates and mahogany bookshelves full of books you can't even read, and a nurse to tend the wife you fucked into an early grave. To Johnny's credit, he doesn't flinch at this little speech, not even the filthy staccato word that punctuates it. Just a long, slow blink as if he doesn't quite recognize my face after all. The ceiling creaks above us. Lights in the electric chandelier give off a shiver. I suck on my cigarette and take a drink.
Well, aren't you going to answer me, you big dumb ox? Or are you on that bastard's side now instead of mine?
Now, Geneva Rose, he says softly. That money's done a lot of good around here.
Oh, I can see that all right. Smart new houses, buildings all cleaned up. I see Carl Green's driving himself a nice new flivver right off the lot. I'll bet everybody in River Junction's got an automobile now and a garage to put it in.
No, I mean, folks can eat regular. Folks can get a doctor when they're sick, get medicine and coal for the winter.
And fancy gold cigarette cases.
Ah, oh, Geneva.
He shakes his head, nudges his glass against mine.
Anyway, where do you think this comes from? All that moonshine you're drinking in New York City? Don't tell me you ain't a-drinking hooch in some joint most nights, you and your friends. It's Duke's hooch you're drinking, ain't it? He's just giving you what you want, what you demand from somewhere, anywhere.
God damn it, Johnny! I hurl my glass into the fireplace, hard, so it shatters good, makes the coals hiss like a snake. God damn the pair of you!
Geneva Rose, you always was a hothead.
I've got a right, don't you think? He doesn't answer. You know what? I should have done something about him years ago. Should have had the nerve to just walk up while he was sleeping and bam, right in his ear. I make my fingers like a revolver, cigarettes sticking in a diagonal line from the imaginary trigger. Then I might have just stayed right here with you and Mama in River Junction, never had to leave.
Law would have found you, though.
Now don't go spoiling my dream, Johnny boy. Don't say it never did cross your mind, neither.
He rolls his shoulders and stares at me piteously.
Lot of folks would have starved or froze to death then. Lot of widows would have had nowhere to live.
Got his finger in every pie, hasn't he? 1,000 little insurance policies to make sure he never goes to jail.
Folks around here die for him now, honey. Remember that.
What about you, Johnny? Would you die for him?
He furrows his 2 thick brows into one, making my stomach knot up.
But before he can open his mouth to answer this important question, a sweet voice pops up from the doorway.
Johnny! Johnny! Who are you talking to?
And I turn my head to find a little girl bearing Mama's hooded eyes and Duke Kelly's dark hair, wearing a pink dress and black patent leather Mary Jane shoes. And Johnny's big voice rolls out from beside me in an entirely different tone.
Why, Patsy Pet, don't you know your own sister? Come home this minute from New York City.
8. I know I'm supposed to say something, call out some greeting, open up my arms so I can embrace this baby sister of mine, who is growing fast into a beauty far more breath-stopping than even her mama. But my limbs seem to have taken on some strange disease of paralysis, some untoward stiffening, while my belly contracts into a hard and sickening ball. Only my heart moves, knocking dizzily into my ribs. Patsy Pet displays no such symptoms of physical malady. She skips right on across all that oriental rug and into Johnny's chest. He's lowered himself to his knees to accommodate her tiny frame, and just sort of peers round his ear and into my face like she can't decide, am I friend or am I foe? I sort of squeak, well now, I was wondering where you got to. Patsy whispers something in Johnny's ear, just exactly the way he used to whisper in mine. And he nods that head of his and lifts her right up into the air, settling her on his hip and turns to me.
Say hello to Geneva Rose, he tells her.
Hello, Geneva Rose.
Somehow I force my right arm into movement. I shift the cigarette into the other hand and lift her little fingers and kiss them. Tiny, perfect nails like chips from a pearl.
Hello, Patsy, darling. I used to rock you to sleep when you were a tiny baby.
She smiles, ducks her head into the safety of Johnny's shoulder. Can't fault her for that, can I? Johnny says,
tell your big sister what you've been doing today.
Reading,
she whispers.
Reading what?
Books.
Big girl books, ain't that right?
Isn't, I say. We say isn't instead of ain't. Isn't that right, Patsy? Patsy giggles into Johnny's jacket.
She's a swell reader, Johnny says. Took to her letters right away. We got a teacher in here just for her. No schoolhouse for Miss Patsy.
What about your numbers, Patsy? Numbers are important, too.
Does her numbers, too. Regular little Einstein, this sweet child.
But mostly you like to read, don't you, darling? I touch her fingers again. I can't help it. Her eyes are a bright, clear blue, the same shade as Mama's, same shade as mine. Patsy nods and moves her thumb against mine, and I'll be damned if that slight little caress doesn't start my eyes stinging.
Yes, I mimic her nod. I can tell. You know why?
Her eyebrows lift up. I lean in close. Because I was just the same way. 9. Now I'm getting sloppy, aren't I? I apologize. Too little sleep, maybe, or else the sight of my mama dying in her luxurious bed upstairs, or the sight of Patsy's pretty eyes, as I said, just exactly like those in Mama's wedding photograph I mentioned earlier, except full of color instead of sepia, and all new and unspoiled. And she likes to read. Well, she doesn't get that from her daddy for certain. Duke can't read. He'd kill me for telling you that, but it's true. I remember how I used to hide inside the library. Not this one, obviously, but the decrepit room tacked onto the dilapidated old shack we call a town hall, baking all afternoon in the chair next to the hot window, until you could stick 4 and 20 blackbirds into me and call me a pie. Miss Tweed was the librarian then. She was the preacher's daughter and awfully young, maybe 17 or 18. The nearest I had to a sister, though we never fixed to speak. We didn't need to. One time, afternoon in the infernal center of July, so hot you might burn your palm just setting it against the window glass, Duke came looking for me, steaming from the ears. Miss Tweed saw him through the door and flicked her finger at me,
And quick as a tick, I ducked under her desk next to her legs. And I listened to that young lady inform my stepdaddy in her calm librarian's voice that no, she hadn't seen me today. Must be too warm indoors. I was more likely cooling off in the creek with the other small fry. And such was Duke's fear of book-learned women, of libraries in general, that he turned away right then, didn't even question her. And when the coast was clear, I crawled out from her desk and we sort of looked at each other, and I saw that her cheeks were as pale as mine, even in that blazing room. She got married soon after, nice young fellow visiting the parsonage from Baltimore, and the library fell into neglect. When I tried to sneak inside the following summer, the door was closed and locked, and nobody seemed to have a key. 10. Composure restored by cigarettes and rye whiskey, I'm ready to climb back up the colossal staircase and sit with Mama until dinner time. Johnny takes Patsy out to play in the snow, and I watch them through the window of Mama's bedroom. There seems to be some kind of formal garden out there, replacing the hen house and the corn crib and the rusting remains of farm machinery, though you can only just trace its neat, boxy edges beneath the snow and imagine how it looks in spring. Down where the trees stick up and the white ground bends south toward the creek, I keep my eyes away. The nurse fidgets a moment and leaves, without saying a word, and I draw the chair closer to the bed and sit down. Mama's hands are quieter now, her eyelids more peaceful. The smell of medicine hangs over her, and the peculiar, sour-sweet scent of death. And I swallow down a mite of bile and open a book on my lap. Little Women, stolen from Duke's new library downstairs, pages crisp and new, bind and rigid with glue. Mama always loved that story. I guess she liked to think that in another time, maybe married to a different man, she might have been some kind of marmy herself, all hoop skirts and wisdom and fortitude and faith. At the sound of my voice, however, her fingers start up the twitching again, her eyelids churn, her lips spasm. I keep on reading in my most soothing voice, thinking maybe it's just the change in the air, the additional stimulation. But her agitation grows and grows, and at last I drop the book on the plush carpet next to the chair legs, and I lay my head on the counterpane next to her thin and struggling chest. I take her cadaverous hand and hold it against my cheek. I don't know which of us I'm trying to quiet. The heat of her fever seeps past my skin. I can't stand the bubbling in her lungs, the death smell of her, the frail, febrile state of her bones in my palm. I want her just to die already, and then my throat and my eyes fill with remorse, which is wet and tastes of salt. In the end, I expect I fall asleep, because when the door bangs open, startling me to my feet, the space behind the curtains has gone entirely dark.
"By the good Lord God," says Duke Kelly, "if it ain't the prodigal daughter."
11. As far as I can remember, my stepdaddy never held down a regular job. Maybe when he was younger, I don't know. He used to say that was because there was no jobs going here in River Junction, but other men found some kind of work, ever how menial, or scratched out a bit of food from the earth for fear of starving otherwise, or else fear of watching their wives and children starve, which most fellows consider even worse. Not Duke, however. Never packed a lunch pail so long as I knew him. Sit and brood, or else meet the other boys for checkers or rye whiskey at the saloon, smoking and flapping their gums all afternoon and sometimes all night. Every so often he would disappear for a day or two and come back with money. I don't know how much, and that's what we lived on. Near as I can tell. But a regular job, not enough for Duke. He was like a man waiting around for a train that didn't come but once a day. Except that you didn't know the exact hour of its arrival, no timetable for a train like that, so there you sat, all day long, doing just enough to keep your heart still beating, just passing time. Now it seems Duke was right about the train.
He certainly wears that air into Mama's bedroom. The air of a man who's been proved right about the most important question in his life. Physically, he's just the same. Hair is black and sleek, not a gray strand daring to touch daylight. Eyes as hard, chin as cleft, shoulders as boxy. Maybe a little rounder around the jowls, but prosperity will do that. The only thing changed is his clothes. He's dressed in a dark, expensive suit, made from the same rarefied grade of cashmere wool as that worn by the partners back at Sterling Bates on the corner of Wall and Broad, and his starched white cuffs are linked in solid gold. From his collar sticks the same stout, tanned country neck, like that of a prize bull. And his thick lips press into the kind of smile that makes me want to leap out the window into the new fallen snow. I turn back to Mama. Be quiet. She's dying.
I know that, sugar.
He walks up behind me and comes to rest just over my right shoulder. I keep my back straight and my eyes on Mama's face. She's turned her head a little, as if hearing Duke's voice, and her fingers twitch against my hand.
Poor thing, he says. Never did have much strength.
Because you kept filling her up with babies, sucking her life away.
Now, just what was I supposed to do, honey? We was man and wife. I never did run around after other women, did I? I kept to your mama just like I vowed.
That's not how I remember it. He laughs.
Now, that's different. Ain't you her own flesh and blood?
You disgust me.
Fine words.
He reaches past me and presses the backs of his fingers against her temple. Her eyes open. She turns her head into his touch.
Where's the nurse gone? Nurse ain't supposed to leave her for a single minute.
I'm here. I'm nursing her.
Well, now, Geneva Rose.
He lifts his hand away and brings it to rest on my shoulder, just under the lobe of my ear, pinky finger pressing intimately against the bare skin of my neck.
That ain't your job, is it?
I knock his hand away and bolt from the chair. You stay away from me. You stay away from the both of us.
She's my wife. I ain't a-going nowhere.
If you touch her again, I'll kill you. He curls his hand around the back of the chair I've just left.
You got no call to speak those words to me, Geneva Rose. I gave you my name and my home. Your mama's had the best money can buy. Just look at her. You want her dying in some damn cotton boarding house, all covered over with fleas?
Better than being bitten by a flea like you. Duke doesn't move. Stands there next to Mama's bed, breathing and staring inside his fine suit of cashmere wool. The radiators hiss at the windows. Around the topmost slat of that chair, his fingers flex and curl, flex and curl.
Look at you, baby. So fine and pretty. Your hair all soft, lips all red, dress all short. Tell your daddy the truth now. How many men you had since you moved to the city?
Dozens. Took me dozens to scrape off the stain of your hands on my skin, Duke Kelly, and I ain't finished yet. I'm here to say goodbye to my mama. And then I'm going back to New York, where I am aiming to take up with the first man I see. He reaches into the inside pocket of his jacket and pulls out a fine gold cigarette case, much like the one Johnny showed me earlier. Takes his time lighting a cigarette with one of those new butane contraptions, also plated in gold.
No, you ain't either. You was going back to that nice young fella you've been stepping out with, ain't that right? That swell college boy you keep tucked up in your bed. That cheap little room of yours? That cheap little room on... Now, where was it? Christopher Street.
No way to describe the sensation that strikes through me at those words. Like an icy bucket over the head, I guess. So cold it freezes your nerves in an instant, numbs the very reflexes that are supposed to save you. I sort of squeak. What do you know about that?
Ah, sugar. I know everything about you. You think I'd let my baby girl go off to New York City without keeping a tender watch over her? I've been watching you all along, Geneva Rose, keeping my eye on you.
He winks, shoots his cuff, takes a long drag on a cigarette and turns his head to gaze down at his wife.
Just like I watch over your mama. What's money for if you can't take good care of your women and children?
You haven't taken good care of her. You've killed her.
Now that ain't fair. The good Lord God be taking her back to his bosom, that's all. Plenty of women had more babies than her. Having babies is natural. What she was put on this good earth to do. Now he be a-calling her back.
He bends over Mama's body and strokes her forehead.
I'm just here to see if she gets the best of everything before she goes. Best money can buy.
Blood money, you mean? Every dollar of it made outside the law.
What do you care? You been drinking your share. Don't you fix to tell me you ain't. Don't fix to tell me you think a fella shouldn't enjoy himself a damn glass of whiskey at the end of a hard day, just on account of the government says he can't. You just mad on account of it's me getting rich instead of some other racket. Look what I've done for this town.
He spreads out his arm.
Every man employed. Every woman got a chicken in her pot, shoes on her feet. You want to take all that away?
No.
Good then, because I ain't going nowhere, Geneva Rose. You remember that.
He holds my mama's hand as he gazes at me, and the look on his smooth face curdles the atmosphere. The fire hisses in the fireplace, piling more heat atop the infernal output of the brand new radiators, and the sweat trickles right down my spine to dampen the back of my girdle, make my stockings prickle on my legs, make my dress feel like a hair shirt, like I want to jump right on out of it, jump on out of myself entirely.
You can do as you like, I reckon. Just stay away from me.
He makes a smile.
You sure about that? You've been living in a rat hole there in New York, a rat hole. You might could live in a castle if you like.
Mama makes a little coughing sound. Legs go thrashing. I bound to the bed, elbow my stepfather aside, lift up her head a little, reach for the glass of water on the bedside table. The coffin stills. She turns her face toward my inner arm like she's catching my scent, and I wet her lips with the water so she can lick it off. I don't imagine she can properly swallow. The bed's hung in heavy red damask, window curtains, too. The color of slow insanity.
Duke says softly, "Don't need to be this way, sugar. You know I can be a right good friend."
"You must be touched. I already told you. You touch me again, and I'll kill you." He laughs.
"Baby girl, I don't mean that kind of friends. Not no more. You is sold goods, Geneva Rose. You been sold good in that city of yours, no mistake, and you can say what you like, but I don't never follow where other men are gone."
"Except with Mama."
"Well, that was different. And your Mama and I, we had an understanding betwixt us, see?"
I stared down at Mama's tormented chest. Beneath that satin counterpane, sawn up and down in a syncopated jazz rhythm. I hate the proximity of Duke's body, the muscular tension of his shoulders, the smell of his breath laden with rye whiskey and good Virginia tobacco. My loathing is so vigorous, so native, that the act of standing next to him requires an extreme exercise of will, the same way you have to force the North Pole of one magnet into the North Pole of another.
"Some understanding," I mutter. "You always was so contrary."
Breath hot on the top of my head.
"You never did comprehend what was good for you."
"What was good for you, you mean?"
"What's that, baby girl? Can't hear you."
"Go to hell." And that's when his hand encircles my throat from behind, without any kind of sound or ceremony. Just those sharp-nailed fingers digging knowledgeably in between the tendons, pressing against the ridges and bumps of my voice box. The cigarette burns a hair's breadth from my skin. He says gently into my ear,
"Don't you go doing nothing stupid, baby girl. You know I don't take kindly to that." There's one thing I can't stand on this earth, and that's a damn Judas. You understand me? I can't exactly speak, so I just nod up and down against the washboard of his chest, while my stomach boils and my ears